Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A bold departure from orthodoxy today. Three guests. That means time is tight, and so there's not much time for me to hold forth. We'll hear from international law professor Heidi Matthews on the World Court's decision that Israel's hold over the occupied territories is illegal, Molly White on how the merchants of crypto are spending their money on politics, and Nausicaa Renner on the tangled psyche of Joe Biden. On July 19th, the International Court of Justice, nicknamed the World Court, issued a ruling declaring Israel's occupation of Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank to be a violation of international law. What does this mean, if it means anything at all? Here to answer that question is Heidi Matthews. She's an assistant professor at the Osgoode Hall Law School of York University in Toronto. Among her specialties are international criminal law and the law of war, meaning that unlike many people who opine on these topics, she actually knows what she's talking about. She was last in this show to analyze the World Court's decision in South Africa's genocide case against Israel. Heidi Matthews. On July 19th, the International Court of Justice issued a ruling about Israel's occupation of Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. What exactly did they say?
The main takeaway, in its sort of simplest terms, I think, really is that the court found Israel's prolonged military occupation of the Palestinian territory to be unlawful. And that is on the basis of a number of extremely serious infractions created by Israel's policies and practices in the occupied territory, so the West Bank, East Jerusalem, but also Gaza, on the basis of the serious infringements by those policies. And so this is the first time that the court has made such a clear finding of illegality around the occupation itself. In 2004, the court had the opportunity in its advisory opinion on the legality of the wall or the security fence or whatever you happen to call it that surrounds and transects and fragments the West Bank. And so in that case, the particular policy and practice of building the wall basically to protect the settlements, essentially, was found to be illegal. But now we have this much, much, much broader finding that is about the occupation in its totality. And so it's really a sweeping finding. And I think I wouldn't want to undersell how sweeping it is. Certain reports have talked, the headlines have focused on settlement policy, etc. Israel's settlement policy has long been established in international law as illegal, right? So that in and of itself is nothing new, but the broader occupation as being unlawful is certainly new.
How does it relate to the earlier decision on the genocide case brought by South Africa, if at all?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think it's important to remember that the genocide case that South Africa has brought against Israel is still in its early stages, right? So the decisions that we have seen in that case, three of them now, have been around the question of provisional measures. So measures that the court mandates that Israel should take in order to protect the rights that are at stake, namely the right of the Palestinian people not to be subjected to acts of genocide. In the interim, between the case being brought, I think, at the end of last year and when it gets decided, which will be some time from now. That's a contentious case, right? It's a case that South Africa has brought as a state against Israel as a state, whereas this advisory opinion is just that. It's an advisory opinion. So it has a slightly different legal standing. A lot of folks are talking about it as a non-binding decision of the court, whereas the decisions the court has taken in the genocide case, of course, are binding. That's true, but I want to point out that an advisory opinion from the ICJ, that jurisdiction exists so that the court can help UN bodies understand how to do their job through the lens of the applicable international law. And so the court still does make a series of actual findings and still does pronounce on what it believes the law to be in the circumstances, which is incredibly important. So they're two different kinds of cases, and also just two different cases. The interaction between them, my own sense, is that reading between the lines with the recent advisory opinion, what we see is emphasis at various places on the way in which the rights violations occasioned by Israel's policies and practices, and so I'm talking about settlement policy, annexation, exploitation and appropriation of natural resources, restrictions on movement, different juridical systems depending on when you're, whether you're Israeli or Jewish versus Palestinian, all of those things sort of taken together. That gives us the background context for understanding the impact of what Israel is doing in Gaza. And so the nearly 57 years of this now unlawful occupation have created a situation, the court says, where the integrity of the Palestinian people as a people has been undermined and infringed. And so there, the possibility, in other words, of their continued existence as a people is also put in jeopardy, not just by what Israel has done in Gaza since October 7th, but by virtue of what it's done for the last 57 years across the entirety of the occupied territory.
These decisions will have several dimensions. The effects will have several dimensions, legal and political. What direct legal effects does this occupation decision have?
Yeah, so this gets us back to the kind of binding, non-binding part. The court elaborates Israel's obligations. Just like in 2004, Israel has clearly said it doesn't think that the court even had jurisdiction to issue this opinion, and it has no intention of complying with it in any way. And so that was the case in 2004, and it's the case now 20 years later. And so I'm not expecting there to be any impact on the ground within Israel and how Israel sort of conceives its domestic legal system vis-a-vis international law, and particularly the world court. So in Israel, I'm not expecting to see much. In fact, what we have seen, I think, in the roughly week or so since this opinion came out, was actually an intensification, really, of violence in Gaza itself, right? So issuing of several new evacuation orders that cover several hundred thousand people, additional massacres, and really just a kind of doubling down on violence in Gaza. We saw that in the aftermath of each of the decisions issuing provisional orders or ordering provisional orders in the genocide case as well. But what I'm looking at in terms of impact then is not so much Israel, although we should be concerned with the way in which the Israeli government sort of claims victimhood based on these decisions of the ICJ and then sort of further supports its right to do whatever it wants genocidally in Gaza, but really for every other state who is a member of the United Nations. And so this is one area where the work of the International Court of Justice is quite different from the work of the International Criminal Court, right, which also has proceedings separately underway. So here, the World Court, and that's why it's called, kind of in quotation marks, the ICJ is often referred to as the World Court because it is the highest judicial body in the UN system, which is basically kind of the centerpiece of international law, or the structuring force in international law since the Second World War. And so when the ICJ pronounces on states' obligations, in particular states' obligations that are called erga omnes, it's a silly Latin word that refers to obligations that are so important in international law, that are so foundational, such as, for example, the right of people to self-determination, which was examined at length in this opinion. Those sorts of obligations are actually owed by each state to every other state, and then correlatively, every state has a duty to ensure that violations of these obligations, these fundamental norms, are not recognized as lawful in any way, and are also brought to an end using lawful means. And so what this decision does then is it clarifies the obligations for every other state in the world vis-a-vis Israel's continued presence in the occupied territory. And so not only is the occupation been found to be illegal, but the court says that Israel is under an obligation to bring it to an end as rapidly as possible, which includes removing its presence including evacuating settlements, but in removing its presence entirely from the occupied Palestinian territory. And so the real impact here, the short story, is to say that all these other states, the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Germany, you know, who are particularly the ones who are propping up and giving financial and material aid and assistance, but also moral support and encouragement to the Israeli government, not just in its war on Gaza, but with respect to the occupation in its entirety, are under an obligation now to actually not render that aid or assistance, and again, not to recognize as legal the situation that has been created by the continued unlawful presence of Israel in the territory. And so from a concrete policy perspective, that can take a lot of different forms. I think the one that most folks are talking about right now is really, what does this mean for the arms trade? We can talk about others, but certainly this really clarifies international legal obligations around things like the arms trade, around preferential free trade agreements with Israel, around corporate or university investments, pension fund investments, et cetera, in companies, not just that, you know, provide arms, et cetera, to Israel, but that in any way support the occupation as well.
I'm speaking with Heidi Matthews, assistant professor at Osgoode Hall Law School, York University, Toronto. And the political fallout, that's a little fuzzier, but it's certainly not good for Israel's standing in the world, not that Israel seems to care, but what do you think this political effects of this decision will be?
Yeah, it's a little early to tell, and I think part of that is because of the political unrest that we're seeing right now in like multiple jurisdictions that are important for the Israeli case. So particularly in the U.S., right, all of this is happening. This opinion comes down right in the middle of the question about whether Biden would be the nominee or not, and Netanyahu's visit to the U.S. and this whole thing. And, you know, the question now about what Harris's policy will be towards Israel, which seems totally uncertain and opaque. So ideally, you know, the United States under, hopefully, a Harris administration would take international law quite seriously and would use this as this opinion as fodder for really substantially changing its policy with respect to Israel, in particular, I mean, most importantly, around, of course, arms shipments and sales. But other states have come out, like sort of the ones you'd expect, those northern states like Ireland and Iceland and Norway, supporting this decision. But again, many of the statements we've seen from states actually have been limited to talking about the settlements and not so much understanding really the broad implications of the policy. And so just as an example, it took Canada, you know, so I'm talking to you from Canada, my home jurisdiction. It took Canada, I think, you know, over a week or about a week to respond at all. They did so in concert with Australia and New Zealand a couple of days ago. And the statement calls on Israel to, quote, ensure accountability for ongoing acts of violence against Palestinians by extremist settlers, reverse the record expansion of settlements, and work towards a two-state solution. So that's a very, very circumscribed interpretation of and reaction to the actual findings of the court in the opinion.
Will Bibi and his cabinet be afraid to travel now? Is there a chance that we could see them in handcuffs someday?
So no, the ICJ doesn't have that jurisdiction, right? So that would be for the ICC. And happening alongside this advisory opinion at the ICJ is, of course, the work at the ICC. So once again, the ICJ deals with contentious disputes between cases and also has an advisory jurisdiction. The ICC deals with criminal cases against individuals. And the prosecutor some weeks ago, as we know, requested arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, along with three Hamas leaders. So we're waiting for the pretrial chamber to make a decision as to whether those arrest warrants should actually be issued. They will do so on the basis of whether or not there are reasonable grounds to believe that the offenses alleged have been committed by the individuals named. The thing that's slowing that down is actually a series of challenges, starting with the UK, to the ICC's jurisdiction which the court has given permission to have aired before it pronounces on the arrest warrants. So whereas we would have thought that the arrest warrants probably would have been issued by now or coming up quite soon, now the court has given permission to a number of states, organizations, and individuals to make representations on the question of jurisdiction before it decides on the question of arrest warrants, which is curious and I think a little bit unexpected. The UK had done this initially under the Sunak government, and then, of course, they have a new Labour government, which has thankfully, after some humming and hawing about it, chosen to withdraw its jurisdictional challenge, which is, like, great news. But the bad thing is that they got the ball rolling, and so now we have all sorts of other folks who have been given permission to make these written representations to the court. And, incidentally, Lindsey Graham is one of them. So.
Oh, my God, no.
Yeah, it's true.
How embarrassing.
It's kind of an absurd situation where the court is now, yeah, considering all of these opinions, including the, learned advice that Lindsey Graham will make.
So what next? Are there other cases against Israel in the docket?
Yeah, several cases, right? So this is this advisory opinion is a very big deal. I want to note, too, that it's not a response to October 7th and Israel's response to October 7th. So this advisory opinion was requested by the General Assembly back in December 2022 at a time when really basic human rights violations against Palestinians in the territory were intensifying already. But before, without any knowledge of what was about to take place in the region. And so this advisory opinion has been in the tubes for quite some time, and it's kind of fortuitous, really, that it comes as an additional piece of the legal puzzle, putting together essentially a case against Israel. So the other cases that to watch for, Germany versus Nicaragua, which we talked about before, still ongoing. Of course, South Africa, with its genocide case against Israel. I've been waiting to see whether South Africa will make yet another request for modification or indication of additional provisional measures, given the deterioration of the situation in Gaza since the last order, which came at the end of May. And so that was when, you'll remember, the Rafah invasion started. And of course, things have substantially deteriorated. And what's really gotten in my craw around the deterioration is the fact that poliovirus has now been detected in wastewater in Gaza, specifically type 2 polio, which no one in Gaza has been vaccinated for since 2016. So really worrying deterioration of the situation, which, of course, human rights organizations, the World Health Organization, et cetera, have all warned about for a long time now, but we're seeing it happen in real time. And so I think we can look for whether South Africa will bring an additional request before the court. And, of course, the stuff at the ICC that we've already talked about. And then given the clarification of all UN member states' obligations with this advisory opinion, I think we are likely to see an intensification of domestic litigation as well. And so there's already quite a bit of domestic litigation, in Canada, the UK, Germany, the US, worldwide, around, in particular, arms exports. But I think that will now intensify and then also expand to include demands on states basically to stop doing anything that would support the continuation of the occupation in general.
That was Heidi Matthews, assistant professor at the Osgoode Hall Law School of York University in Toronto. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Heavenly Pop Hit by The Chills, one of a flock of great bands that came out of New Zealand in the 1980s and 1990s, centered around the city of Dunedin and the label Flying Nun Records. The founder of The Chills, Martin Phillips, died July 28th at the age of 61. The band and the whole scene produced some lovely music. Next, how the crypto business, an enterprise I hold in very low regard, is turning into a major political actor. To tell that story, we're joined by Molly White, a software engineer-turned-writer whose beat is a critical look at a dubious industry. She just started a project called Follow the Crypto, where she's tracking where they're spending their money in the 2024 election season. Her newsletter, Citation Needed, is a great way of keeping up in the game. Molly White. Crypto looks to be coming an issue in the presidential campaign. Before we get into the money flows and such, let's talk first about the candidates' positions. Trump, who just a few years ago correctly described Bitcoin as a scam, is now fervently pro. Now, it's really hard to figure out why this unprincipled huckster does anything, but what do you make of this shift, and what's he promising the crypto community?
Well, the shift seems fairly self-serving. He is certainly trying to earn support from the crypto base, which, in fairness, supported him largely already, but certainly has been looking for candidates to come out very explicitly in support of cryptocurrency. His promises to them most recently announced at the Bitcoin 2024 conference, where he was a headline speaker, included firing Gary Gensler, the SEC chairman, on day one in office. He made promises to never sell any of the cryptocurrency that the federal government holds, which is primarily through seizures of cryptocurrency from various law enforcement actions, which he compared to a sort of strategic reserve, although it wouldn't necessarily be a strategic reserve. And then just sort of broad claims around installing people to write the rules for the cryptocurrency industry who love your industry and things like that, you know, signaling a much more supportive regulatory posture than the cryptocurrency at least feels that it's been getting from the Biden administration.
I noticed that some of these people, I can't remember if Trump himself did this, but certainly some of his allies have, they're talking about using some of the Federal Reserve's currency reserves and placing them into crypto. Is that part of this crypto enthusiast platform or wish list?
It seems to be lately. I think it mostly came from promises from RFK Jr., who's also running for president, who promised to make a very significant Bitcoin strategic reserve. Trump did not make any promises about going out and purchasing Bitcoin to hold. His was more about holding on to cryptocurrency that the government sort of happens to have or comes into. But there have been promises and proposals, including recently by Senator Cynthia Lummis, who's been a longtime friend of the cryptocurrency industry, to establish a strategic reserve denominated in Bitcoin.
And what else do they want? What's their wish list look like?
Most of it really focuses on the regulatory end of things. The cryptocurrency industry, broadly speaking, feels that the Securities and Exchange Commission, chaired by Gary Gensler, has been on the attack against the industry. They complain that there is not enough regulatory clarity and that the industry needs bespoke regulations because it is so different from other similar industries and products that might fall under the securities regime. So they are looking for regulations that sort of enshrine some of the things that the cryptocurrency industry has been doing already, but not necessarily with the blessing of the agencies in charge of regulating it. They often wish to see a different agency installed as the primary regulator, namely the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, which is mostly motivated by the fact that it's a smaller agency with much fewer resources that it would be challenging for the CFTC to take such an aggressive stance towards the industry without a significant increase in their resources. And so the hope from the industry really is that the sort of more toothless regulator might be installed and put in charge of them, allowing them to sort of continue doing whatever they wish without increased consumer protections and regulations on the space.
Now, the Democrats, who at least in part had been crypto hostile or at least not crypto boosters, are now allegedly reaching out. Are they? And if so, how?
Right. So it's challenging to say because a lot of the stories about specifically Kamala Harris and her campaign making overtures towards the cryptocurrency industry are coming out of the cryptocurrency industry themselves. So there were stories about her potentially speaking at the same Bitcoin conference, which were coming out of the CEO of the Bitcoin conference, who obviously has a vested interest in drumming up press coverage. There have been other reports about her seeking a reset with the cryptocurrency industry and speaking with companies like Coinbase about regulations. Again, it's been challenging to actually confirm those reports, and it's not clear if any of them have been confirmed from people who are, you know, within the Harris campaign or at least not within the cryptocurrency industry. But there have been some overtures from the broader Democratic Party. There was a letter recently from a number of Democratic Congress people that was encouraging a less aggressive stance towards the industry and sort of trying to mend relations. So there have been some candidates and people who are sitting Congress people who are taking a slightly friendlier approach towards the industry, although many of them had been friendly towards the industry for some time. And then we're seeing a slew of candidates on both sides of the aisle who are running for office and trying to include in their platforms various comments about blockchain innovation and, you know, making space for such a thing.
I wonder how many of them understand what that means, even.
Well, yeah, that's really the question, I think. It's often sort of an afterthought and not a primary feature of the platform, although there are a handful of candidates that are running more or less specifically on blockchain policy.
Do voters care about this? I mean, what's driving this interest in the politicians?
Well, the crypto industry certainly wants you to think so. They've been doing a very strong campaign to suggest both to politicians and to the general public that there is this large contingency of crypto voters who will affect the outcomes of elections all the way from state level to federal. I don't believe the data actually supports that there is such a group of people. There are certainly individuals who are strongly making votes based on their crypto ideology. But broadly speaking, I think most people who hold cryptocurrency are pretty normal, nuanced people who are not voting specifically on that issue and who have much broader goals for the people they wish to see put into office. Polling around cryptocurrency voter sentiment has come only out of the industry and so is very dubious, I would say, especially the specific surveys that I've read, and don't really support the narrative that there is this group of people who might be willing to overlook partisan alliances or other policy disagreements specifically because a candidate aligns with them on cryptocurrency.
So what are the numbers on crypto ownership and trading? The industry, as you mentioned, is touting some big numbers. The Federal Reserve Survey, they've been asking these questions for a few years, shows pretty small and even shrinking numbers. What's the truth here?
The cryptocurrency industry likes to throw around the number 52 million, which would amount to about 20% of the adult American population. This, again, is based on a survey with very questionable methodology, and it was one that was funded by Coinbase, which is the largest American cryptocurrency exchange. As you mentioned, there's a different survey from the Federal Reserve that also surveyed adult American cryptocurrency ownership that found the number to be closer to 7%, which would amount to about 18 million people, which is a substantially smaller portion. And as you alluded to, it's been shrinking over the past 3 years that they've surveyed on the decline since 2021.
I'm speaking with Molly White, a sharp critic of the crypto world. Let's talk a bit about the culture of crypto. It's extremely fervent, as I'm sure you've experienced very directly. What really drives them? I guess there's several groups we're talking about here, the executives from the industry. Obviously, what's driving them is money-making. There are also broader tech interests that seem to have some crypto-adjacent feelings. And then there are rank-and-file enthusiasts. So talk some about who these people are and what their passions are, what drives their fascination with these bizarre instruments.
Well, I think you're very right to point out that it's not this sort of monolithic group and that there are different contingents within it. And I try to identify in my writing that there is a difference between the industry and the executives who are pushing very hard for many of these policy changes. And then the people who just hold crypto or are enthusiasts or hobbyists or, you know, whatever degree that they get involved, they don't always hold the same beliefs. There are certainly some people within the cryptocurrency community who are focused mostly on money and are interested in, you know, anything that might make the value of their crypto holdings go up. There are also people who are very ideologically tied to cryptocurrency and who view it as a instrument for financial freedom, you know, a way to transact outside of the bounds of government oversight. They believe strongly in privacy and particularly the right to financial privacy, which does not really exist in the United States. And so they are sort of on the more ideological end of things rather than solely focused on what has become known as number go up ideology, you know, sort of the idea that anything that makes the price go up is good. And so, you know, like I said, there's sort of a broad range of people and the beliefs cross the range as well.
That Fed survey showed only about 1% of the public has used cryptocurrency to buy something. It's not easy to buy something with crypto, so that's understandable. But how do they see it? It's just an asset, you know, the number go up crowd. What is it? Is it a money? Is it a security? An investment? What exactly is it to these people?
Right. I mean, it really depends on who you're talking to, and sometimes the use of it can change even in the context of a single conversation. But there are different viewpoints. Some people view it as a hedge against inflation. That's been a sort of recent talking point around cryptocurrency, especially as inflation in the United States has been somewhat higher. People talk about it as a stable store of value. People talk about it as, again, as a currency, although, as you mentioned, it's not widely used as a currency and it's not particularly well suited towards that. And then there are a lot of people who view it as an investment. They buy some hoping to buy low and potentially sell high. Some people say that they will hold on to it forever and never cash it out. But I think a lot of people are just hoping for an increase in their investment.
We don't really know much about the structure of these markets, right? They're very opaque. Who are the big actors? Who's going in and out? How concentrated ownership is? We really don't have such a great picture of that, do we?
There's definitely been some research on it that shows a fairly high concentration, especially when it comes to Bitcoin, among a very small number of cryptocurrency wallets. But it is challenging to identify which wallets are associated with an individual versus, an entire cryptocurrency company. Or sometimes those studies inadvertently identify wallets that belong to, say, a cryptocurrency exchange that does not necessarily hold all of the cryptocurrency themselves. It's just holding it on behalf of many, many other people. But the research that has been done does show a pretty strong concentration in Bitcoin ownership, certainly far more concentrated than the distribution of the U.S. dollar. There's been a lot of criticism as far as wealth distribution in the United States around, you know, the 1% owns a huge amount of the wealth. It's far worse in Bitcoin from the studies that have been performed thus far.
Okay, now let's talk a bit about your project now, Follow the Crypto. What is the industry up to? How much are they giving and to whom?
Sure. So especially this most recent election cycle, the cryptocurrency industry has really focused on fundraising to influence politics. And so far, it's mostly been congressional races, although there's been increasing involvement in presidential races as well. The industry has already raised around $182 million into a couple of mostly related super PACs, which are then distributing funds to various congressional races, both to support candidates that they believe will be friendly to the industry and also to try to oust candidates who either have a record of voting against policies that they would have liked to see installed or who appear to be aligned with those who have been opponents of the industry.
And what about partisan leanings, Democrat or Republican or RFK Jr.?
Certainly a little bit of everything. But as far as the super PAC expenditures, it's been more or less equivalent as far as supporting Republicans and Democrats with a slight edge to Republicans. So it's been around $16 million to support Republicans and almost $14 million to support Democrats. Like I mentioned, there's also been a significant amount of opposition spending. So the super PACs have spent far more to oppose Democrats than they have Republicans. They've spent almost $14 million again to oppose Democrats, whereas only around $300,000 have gone to opposing Republicans. So there's definitely a stronger partisan leaning there, although I've noted that in many cases they are opposing Democratic candidates while at least incidentally supporting other Democrats. So it's not necessarily, you know, they're so involved in primary races at this point that in many cases it's actually other Democrats who are benefiting from that opposition spending.
Now, my sense is that a lot of this world leans pretty far to the right. And when it comes to political spending, they're pretty much single-issue voters, right?
With the super PACs, that's been the stated goal, at least, is that they will support people on any side of the aisle if they are allied with the cryptocurrency industry. Certainly, some of the strongest allies have been among the Republicans, although, as we discussed a little bit earlier, there have been allies on the Democratic side of things as well. I think it'll be interesting to watch as the elections draw a little bit closer and as we get into the general election season, how the partisan spending unfolds, because it's still fairly early. They've only spent around $44 million of that $182 million. So there's still an enormous amount of money that they're planning to spend in this election cycle that's gone unspent thus far.
And finally, ever since I've been following this stuff, which is over a decade, I've been hearing that blockchain technology has many uses aside from cryptocurrencies. Has that actually panned out?
That, I think, is a little bit harder to support. The idea that blockchain technology is broadly useful besides its use in terms of creating this currency that, or this asset, at least, that people are trading. There have been a lot of proposals around using blockchain technology for supply chains and to cryptographically prove ownership of various assets and all sorts of things. Anything you can think of, someone has suggested doing it with a blockchain. But the technology itself has many, many flaws that are often not something that can be overcome easily. And the benefits that blockchain technology provides in terms of, you know, its very specific security features are often actually not needed in the cases where people are proposing them. In cases where people are concerned about supply chain integrity, the types of attacks that a blockchain could help to protect against are not the types of attacks that people are actually seeing. You know, people are worried about fraud and bad information being put into the supply chain, and that's not something a blockchain can necessarily guard against. And so you end up using a technology that has features that you don't really need and so many drawbacks that are considerably worse than a more traditional database technology in terms of speed, expense, the ability for other people to get involved and you know, become a partner on the blockchain, et cetera. You know, so I am very skeptical when people talk about applying blockchain technology outside of the cryptocurrency use case.
Protecting against fraud is pretty funny given the industry's own troubles with fraud.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real selling point. You know, people will say, oh, blockchains are so secure. You can trust the data on the blockchain because they can't tamper with it. But people forget that there are a lot of different ways that fraud happens. And so if you put bad data on the blockchain, there's nothing about a blockchain that prevents a person from putting bad data on the blockchain. You end up with bad data, and that's not something that a blockchain fixes. Similarly, people will say, oh, Bitcoin has never been hacked. You know, you can't just hack the Bitcoin blockchain and steal someone's money or spend their money. That ignores the fact that people have their Bitcoin stolen from them constantly, you know, every day through other forms of attacks that are just very common, phishing attacks and the types of attacks that you might see on, you know, very standard asset classes where someone just, you know, steals your password and then they've got your bank account information, or in this case, your control of your cryptocurrency assets. And, you know, there's nothing about a blockchain that stops that from happening. And I think that's been sort of a successful marketing strategy on the cryptocurrency side of things, but one that has caused a lot of people to lose a lot of money because they believe what they're being told, that cryptocurrency is secure and safe and they don't have to worry, when in fact there are myriad attacks outside of the very specific attack vector that blockchains aim to protect against.
That was Molly White, a prolific critic of the crypto racket. You can find out about all her projects on her website, mollywhite.net, mollywhite.net. And now a look inside Joe Biden's psyche, which admittedly might not be the most alluring prospect. To lead us on that journey, we're joined by Nausicaa Renner, author of an article on the topic in Parapraxis, a journal of psychoanalysis that takes both print and web form. She spent 5 years at The Intercept, but in February joined the long and rather sad exodus from that site. But she's found a new home as one of the founders, along with Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill, of Dropsite News, which describes itself as providing independent news on politics and war. Not to be excessively rude about it, but having Biden drop out is rather like lopping off a bit of necrotic flesh off the body politic, isn't it?
That's a great first question. So the reason that I got really interested in the Biden presidency is, you know, when we were covering his campaign in 2020, when I was at The Intercept, we were very critical of Biden. His past positions did not seem to augur well for his presidency. And then, you know, like a lot of people on the left, we were really surprised when he came in and he actually had a lot of policies that were economically pretty radical in the COVID recovery. And then Gaza happened and it seemed to go in the other direction again, where then for people on the left, he became all bad again. I was really interested in the way that he got split between, okay, like at first he was all bad, we didn't want him in. And then it was like, oh my gosh, wow, surprise, he's amazing. And then it was like, well, he is the angel of death. You know, and then when he sort of presented as sicker and sicker as time went on, that was interesting too. It was sort of like he was maintaining his grip on power when he had basically promised not to. And why was he doing that? What about Biden allowed him to occupy these different positions over time? And he was really sort of throwing me for a loop. So, you know, that's why I kind of wrote this piece, was to explore this whiplash that happened in terms of what Biden's presidency came to represent at various points in time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought of this as I was reading your piece. He's in some ways a really colorless figure, but on the other hand, he excited these extremes of feeling. There's something really odd about that.
Yeah, when you look at it psychoanalytically, like, I don't really want to attempt to explain the intricacies of psychoanalytic theory, but one of the most basic parts of psychoanalysis are that people repeat themselves, and that what the repetition is about just recreating feeling states that are familiar to you. The only way that I could begin to understand the policy whiplash was to start thinking about, like, what might be going on inside of Biden's own mind. That's when things started to get really interesting for me. You know, in the piece I talk about, back in 2019, Fenton O'Toole wrote a piece for the New York Review of Books all about Biden's history, his very sad past with his first wife and children, and how he was sort of bringing this grieving, mourning sense to the presidency.
Yeah, the death in his family, before he started really declining, he still had this aura of death about him. But on the other hand, it seemed kind of tranquilizing. He was going to be some kind of national tranquilizer after the dislocations of Trump and COVID. There's some way in which that deathly aura around him was calming, I guess.
He came in at a point when the people in the United States were really feeling unhinged. You know, we had 4 years of Trump and people were exhausted. People felt crazy. There were a lot of splits in sort of the American psyche between different factions. And Biden really came in, and I wouldn't say that he was exactly a unifier, but he seemed to be able to deal with and nullify the sense of total chaos and emergency that Trump left us with. He dealt with that in a relatively professional way, I thought, and spoke to the fissures rather than amplifying the chaos.
But then as time went on, he began to look more and more like a semi-animate memento mori. As you put it, the healthy dose of death became a destructive one.
I'm sure many of your listeners have read Shock Doctrine and read about moments where, like, capitalism comes in and takes advantage of moments of disaster and crisis to sort of tighten its lock on the population. And in this case, it was sort of the opposite. I mean, COVID came in and we had Trump, and then Biden came in, and it was a really special moment legislatively in terms of being able to get policy through. That I originally started writing this piece about how there was this atmosphere of emergency and urgency. If you even think back to like the first days of COVID, like it didn't seem possible that our society could change as much as it did. And then when, you know, the American Rescue Plan came in and we had student debt paused and stimulus checks and the child tax credit increased, all of these things felt like a very healthy dose of like, let's acknowledge the reality of what's going on. Let's take COVID seriously. And then he preemptively ended that period because the vaccine was coming out and it was, quote unquote, time to move on from this period of emergency. But that's when I really feel like there was a shift in the Biden presidency from this energetic, in psychoanalysis, the life instinct and the death instinct always go together. You know, he was bringing energy, but also bringing a sense of calm. And then, yes, that really switched in the months leading up to the midterms.
Yeah, and then Gaza. I was supposed to write a piece for Jacobin on Bidenomics, and I was going to say some good things. And then the Gaza war started, and it became impossible for me to say anything nice about him. Like, it completely transformed my view of him. And I had to pause for a few months before I could, like, find anything to say. And it ended up being more negative than it would have been had I written it 5 or 6 months earlier. There's something really changed about him.
And, like, how can you even begin to understand how those two people could be the same person? I mean, it doesn't make sense from a political standpoint. You have to try to understand it psychically. And, like, the only way that I've been able to make sense of it is by understanding that domestically, Biden was quite ambitious. You know, he wanted to be like LBJ and like FDR. Like, he really wanted his name in the history books. That ended with a very good result domestically, in my view. But then you look at foreign policy and you look at his treatment of people outside of what I would call like the self of the U.S. And he, an avowed Zionist, includes Israel in his sense of self. There's no border in his mind between the U.S. and Israel.
You read a bit about the growth of end times thinking across the political spectrum. You know, there's this left fear of climate change, human extinction. And then you have Lauren Boebert welcoming it as a sign of the Savior's imminent return. How do you read this obsession with end times and this universalization of death?
It's actually a part of the left that I have grown increasingly skeptical of, to my own surprise. A few years ago, I was really captured by apocalyptic thinking around the climate, and it was giving me panic attacks. I mean, I really felt it deeply. And then I think after one of the worst moments, you know, when I was sort of like, why am I having children? Everything is going to be over. I realized that there was a political purpose to all of it, and that I started to feel like the level of fear and anxiety that some people on the left have, it's not exactly that it's misplaced, but it's hard with climate because on the one hand, like the dangers are extremely real. But I also think that there are portions of the population that are kind of caring more about it than the other parts of the population. And the people who care about it are carrying a heavy weight because the other people are refusing to think about it.
Yeah, I have an 18-year-old son who doesn't really think about it very much. I sometimes envy him. I think it gives him a level of mental health that many of us are lacking.
There's a feeling that the more upset you are about it and the more desperate you feel and the more you work to talk about the apocalyptic possibilities in the future, I think people rely on that to change things. But actually, I think that like that's not really how political change actually comes about. You know, of course you need a movement, but you can't have a movement of people sort of wringing their hands. I mean, it just hasn't worked. Like that has actually been one of my biggest disappointments in politically on the left has been the erosion of the Sunrise Movement, which played a big role in 2018 and now feels like a distant memory in some ways. So I would love to make that the subject of another piece at some point.
That kind of despair is demobilizing. It's not energizing.
Well, except for people like Lauren Boebert, apparently. Like,
yes, but if you believe Jesus is coming, that makes all the difference.
In our system, you know, I think to make change, we tend to rely on that kind of energy, which can be very motivating, and it can open up possibilities, but it can also be incredibly freezing and disarming and destructive.
To conclude, you say a final loss to Trump may have been Biden's secret wish. Could you expand on that?
I guess in the vein of thinking about Biden as a figure who is repeating himself, Biden has a history of almost being the trophy winner. You know, he's had a few campaigns for president. He finally won. Even in this presidency, like, his stance on Israel and the war in Gaza has totally sabotaged what was going to be one of the most amazing presidencies from a progressive perspective that we've had in generations. There's something about Biden. If there's anybody who's actually a therapist or a psychoanalyst listening to this, they may be cringing because, you know, from a psychological perspective, you're not really supposed to be speculating this much about what's going on in somebody's world. But
yes, it's radio. It's okay.
It's radio. It's okay. And this is, you know, I can't help myself. This is what I think about all the time. I just have to think that he has a life that is full of the car crash with his wife and his baby daughter dying. This is an incredibly traumatic situation, and it really foreclosed what could have been a great future for him, and it feels like he does that over and over again. You know, when I wondered if his secret wish may be to lose to Trump, I guess I was imagining what it must be like to be him and thinking, why is he doing this? Like, why? Like, what is his motivation to sort of sabotage himself?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Nixon, who just constantly was punishing himself out of God knows why. But
yeah, I mean, it happens all the time with like all of his gaffes, and he's very fixated on his public presentation and his stutter, and it definitely, you can tell that it occupies a lot of mental space for him.
That was Nausicaa Renner, one of the founders of Dropside News and author of an article psychoanalyzing Joe Biden in Parapraxis. Back in January 2020, Branko Marcetic published a book on Biden called Yesterday's Man. That label fits better now than it did 3.5 years ago. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some more from The Chills, whose founder Martin Phillips died on July 28th. This is from The Oncoming Day. Till next week, bye.
All is there, the road.